This meeting is now being recorded.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 3, String Contention, Objections, and Disputes, held on the 20th of June, 2017. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? And I do have Jamie Baxter noted. Thank you. Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for recording purposes and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. And with this, I will turn it over to our co-chair, Karen Day. Please begin.
Thank you. Good morning, afternoon, good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on our last Work Track 3 meeting before Johannesburg. We have a couple of guest speakers with us today, so I think we will have a lively and informative discussion today. Let's first take a brief moment and review the agenda. The staff has it over in the right-hand column. We will go through our normal process of asking for any SOI updates. We'll have a status update from one of our plenary chairs. Then we will start into our deep dive into the new GTLD accountability mechanisms, specifically today, the revised IRP process. And we have David McCauley from the IRP work team with us to do that, and some lessons learned from the first instance of a PIC DRP accountability action. And we have one of the parties of that proceeding with us to give us some feedback on procedural aspects of the PIC DRP. We will quickly then look at our discussion topics for our face-to-face with ICANN and then any other business that we have. Does that agenda sound good to everyone? Anybody have anything to add or suggested changes at this point in time? Raise your hand. Speak up. Seeing none, Ann says it looks good to her. We will then move on. Do we have anyone on the call today that needs to alert us to an update of their SOI? I'm seeing none, no raised hands, nothing in the chat. Again, just a reminder that if you do have a change to your employment or your work with ICANN, your relationship to any ICANN parties, you should update your SOI, and then we can be alerted to that at our next meeting. Next, we will then move on to get an update from our plenary chair. Let's see who's on the call. Aubrey, would you like to go and let us know where we are with the full group?
Sure. This is Aubrey speaking. So we had a meeting recently, and in our last plenary meeting, we basically spoke about the last of the three subgroups that we've, not subgroups, but drafting teams we've got on the community comment one issues, the one dealing with, rounds and first come, first serve. Those documents are still online. Those documents are still open for people to comment and suggest, suggest text changes. And we still really do need to come to, group decisions on those. We're now preparing for, the Johannesburg meeting. We will have a face-to-face session with the of the group in which we'll spend a little bit of time on the CC1 topics, and then each of the work tracks, the subtracks, will take one, maybe two of their issues and discuss it and at length with the whole community. there to input. So we're hoping we'll be able to make a fair amount of progress on that. And the other thing is we've been working on the cross-community meetings. We've got two of them on geo names at the top level. Jeff and I put out a straw person, which is basically an example of taking the various proposals that were put together and trying to assemble a single story out of them. This is an example. It's a place to start the discussions. We're avoiding calling it a proposal, but we really did want to show that it is possible to fabricate a possible solution that took into account the concerns of the various proposal writers. And so I encourage you all to read the straw person that we sent out and look at the chart that was put out that compares the various models and various proposals that people have put forward. I think that's about it at the moment, unless there are any questions for me. I'll turn it back over to the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Aubrey. Does anyone have any questions or follow-up for our plenary chairs before we move on to our meeting? Seeing none, we will move on then. Let's do first a brief recap for those that weren't able to join us last week of what exactly we're looking at when we are looking at these new GTLD accountability mechanisms. In our charter, as far as accountability mechanisms, we are tasked with examining whether dispute resolution and challenge processes provide adequate redress options, or if additional redress options specific to the new GTLD program are needed. During the past round, there are four accountability mechanisms available to new GTLD in relation to the new GTLD program. The first of these is the independent review process, known as the IRP. This is a process based out of ICANN's bylaws. In the new bylaws, it's section 4.3. And as we are all aware, with the revision of the ICANN bylaws, the Workstream 2 accountability team has had an independent review process working group, which has fleshed out the new IRP process, and we will be looking at that in depth today. That has been utilized many times during the past few years. So we will look at what the new process is and based on and whether or not we feel like that is going to be adequate for the new GTLD mechanisms. The next is the Public Interest Dispute Resolution Procedure, the PICDRP. This procedure can be invoked when a party feels that a registry has not complied with the PICs in its registry agreement. We've had one PICDRP procedure to date, and as I alluded to earlier in the introductions, we have one of the parties of that proceeding who would like to share with us today some observations on how that process worked the first time. The third mechanism that we in Work Track 3 were going to be looking at is the Registry Restrictions Dispute Resolution Procedure. This is an offshoot of the whole community process that we have looked at earlier, and this procedure can be invoked when an established community that has a relationship to a community-based TLD feels that they are being harmed by the community TLD registry operator's non-compliance with registration restrictions. To date, this process has not been invoked. So we could look at this through the lens of the Newman rule and say we don't have any evidence that it didn't work, so we can carry it forward into subsequent procedures. But of course, if anyone has any experience with thinking about invoking this RRDRP or where that it could have been used but wasn't been used, we would appreciate that being shared with the group as well. The fourth accountability mechanism is the trademark post-delegation dispute resolution procedure, and this is for a trademark owner that feels like they are being harmed by a registry's manner of use or operation of its TLD. And prior to the kickoff of both our PDP and the rights review, rights protection mechanism review PDRP, the GNSO leadership and the PDP leadership agreed that the trademark post-delegation dispute resolution procedure would be best dealt with in the RPM PDP. And those of you that are following that are aware that they have spent a considerable amount of time on that one. So we will not be diving into that one here. So that's just a brief catch-up of what the mechanisms are that we've been tasked to review, the lens through which we're to look at this, if they worked, if we need to do anything different for the next round. First up today, we will go into an overview of the independent review process. And we're very fortunate to have with us today David McCauley on behalf of the IRP Implementation Oversight Team. And David is going to walk us through the new IRP process, share with us how it's envisioned working, what some of the differences are, and if you have any questions, please, once David is finished, we'll have a time for question and answer. Please, let's welcome David, and I will turn it over to you now.
Thanks very much, Karen. It's David McCauley speaking. And I want to thank the group for inviting me on. Let me just, I know many of the people in the group, but let me just introduce myself a little bit further. I am the lead of the implementation oversight team for the new IRP. And it's a small group. One other person in this group is a member, that's Aubrey. And we are making progress through our work. I personally am an employee of the VeriSign policy team. I participate in both the registry stakeholder group and in the CCNSO and in a number of Workstream 2 subgroups. And the IRP, which I'll speak about this a little bit later, the IRP IoT started within the CCWG for accountability, but is now a bylaws recognized effort. So looking at this first slide that's now on the screen before the group, and hearing Karen speak about what the focus is here, I think I can truncate this a little bit, but let me just mention that the new IRP is indeed under Section 4.3 in the bylaws. It's an important section, goes on at some length to describe what the IRP's purpose is, how it's going to be set up, and how it's going to run, and what it's meant to achieve. The agenda that I'll speak today is sort of threefold. One, what's the purpose of the IRP? Two, what do we in the IoT see as the main pillars? These aren't the only parts of the IRP, but they're really the three constituent main parts of the IRP. And then a few miscellaneous bits at the end. So if I could go to the next slide. The purpose of the IRP is pretty much, as I indicate on the slide, indicated in Section 4.3A, but it is largely to ensure that ICANN does not exceed its mission. It is a new standard that was put into effect on October 1st of last year, and when I say a new standard, the previous IRP was really a review of procedural correctness. In other words, it was an arbitration-like forum to double-check that ICANN had followed procedures. But the previous IRP didn't get to the nub of the question, was the decision that ICANN made valid or not? It was simply a procedural review. That's changed as of October 1st of last year. The IRP now is meant to ensure that ICANN does not exceed mission, that it does comply with the bylaws, and as a consequence, the standard now is that an IRP can review whether or not ICANN violated the articles or the bylaws. And when I refer to ICANN, that means the board collectively or individual officers. It means officers of the corporation and staff. And so it is a meaningful change in the IRP process, and it's quite an important accountability measure that Workstream 1 worked at great length to put in place. You can see on the slide there's other things it's meant to do, ensure ICANN accountability, empower the community and claimants to enforce compliance. It is also meant to address some contractual issues, that is, with respect to the IANA naming functions contract and PTI services. And I'll speak a little bit about those later. But by and large, the review under IRP is, did, in fact, ICANN violate articles or bylaws? Could I get the next slide, please? Thank you. Other purposes are to ensure that there's accessible, transparent, efficient, consistent, just resolution of disputes. The standing panel that I'll speak about in a little while is one of the important ways that that's meant to be done. Importantly, the second bullet on this page says this is meant to lead to binding final resolutions consistent with international arbitration norms. The words binding and final are important there. Binding in the sense that this is a process that can be enforced both by the empowered community and by individuals that come to an IRP. Next slide. And while we're moving, I'll just mention the final bullet, the previous page, was this is meant to be an alternative to civil litigation. That's an important point. Many people have noted that IRPs themselves are expensive. If you go into the record of IRPs that have been handled at ICANN and look at the fees that are involved, attorney's fees and things like that, they are expensive. But the point is that they are presumably much less expensive than civil litigation and hopefully much less extensive and quicker. I spoke about three main pillars. One is the new standard of review. I mentioned that. That is, it's a substantive review of whether ICANN's actions or inactions, that's an important phrase, or inactions, have amounted to a violation of bylaws or articles. The second point is there now will be a standing panel, that is, a standing panel of panelists who are those persons almost like jurists who will sit on panels to decide IRP cases. And then the third main pillar to try and get this thing launched is the new supplementary rules of procedure. I think most people appreciate the fact that whenever you go to a forum, the rules of procedure under which you operate oftentimes color the ability to get things done in a fair manner. Our team is now engaged in looking at updated supplementary rules of procedure, making the rules conform to the new IRP. It's an extensive process, and I'll speak about that in just a few moments. Next slide, please. When I speak about the new standard of review, this slide and I think the next one gets into exactly what does that mean. And as I said before, it covers the board, the directors, officers, and staff. And the standards are, did they exceed their mission? Two, was there something that amounted to a breach of the bylaws that resulted from a response that ICANN took or an action that ICANN took in response to advice rendered by an advisory committee or a supporting organization, and someone claims that they're inconsistent with the articles or bylaws. Third is highlighted in yellow because it's important to this group, in my opinion. and that is the IRP is specifically under the bylaws empowered to hear cases that result from decisions of process-specific expert panels that are claimed to be inconsistent with the articles or bylaws. These are those panels under the applicant guidebook, like string similarity objections, legal objections, community objections, those kind of things. And so that's now recognized in the bylaws as being appealable to an IRP, again, under the standard that the decision of the panel the enforcement of the decision of the panel would amount to a breach of bylaws or articles. Next slide, please. If I'm going too fast, please let me know. I just saw a hand, but it went away. I'm sorry I didn't recognize who that was. Things that come under the new standard of review, ICANN's responses to requests for documents under the new DIDP policy that the transparency subgroup is putting together can be appealed. Again, the standard would be, did ICANN's action amount to a breach of the bylaws? But it's an important review for the new DIDP that's being cobbled together. The empowered community is going to be able to bring claims to IRP. and contractual rights, again, as I said, the IANA naming functions contract and the PTI services will be reviewable at IRP if someone believes that ICANN's failure to act amounted to a breach of the bylaws. Next slide, please. I did make a note of things that are specifically excluded from IRP. This was the result of Workstream 1 deliberations. Empowered community challenge to the results of a PDP can't be reviewed at IRP unless the SO that approved the PDP supports that challenge. And then other ones, CCTLD delegations and redelegations, numbering resources and protocol parameters issues are also not appealable to IRP. Next slide, please. This is an important point. I just left it one thing on this slide. The nature of the review here is objective and de novo. That's actually an important legal principle. And so if someone were to claim, for instance, as one example, that a decision of a expert panel below was incorrect to the extent and to an extent that it amounted to a violation of the bylaws, the hearing at the IRP would not be a review of the decision below necessarily. It would be an objective de novo inquiry into the issue as to whether the decision would amount to a breach of the bylaws. Next slide, please. Now we get to the standing panel, and this is an important constituent part. We need to get this IRP launched. We need a standing panel. It's in the bylaws in 4.3J. It's an interesting section. It describes the qualifications for the standing panelists, the training, the kind of background. I didn't put that information here. You can see it at 4.3J if you're interested. There will have to be at least 7 members on the initial standing panel. Now, the way an IRP case will be heard is a 3-member panel will hear a case. One member of the standing panel will be selected by ICANN. One member will be selected by the claimant. Those two will select third panelist. And that's the way an IRP individual case will be heard. Cases will be appealable to the full standing panel. But you need a standing panel in order to have the bandwidth to hear IRP cases going forward. ICANN has an obligation to train them, things like that, with respect to DNS, not with respect to legal functions. The standing panel will have a secretariat. Currently, it's the International Center for Dispute Resolution, which is the international arm, I believe, of the American Arbitration Association. In order to get to the standing panel, ICANN is going to release a document calling for expressions of interest. And it'll be for potential IRP panelists from around the world. There are some requirements for diversity, and you can see those in the bylaw. The expression of interest document is basically done. The IRP IoT team has had a hand in helping ICANN come up with a document. It's not yet been released, and it's important to move this forward. On the other hand, there is a corollary obligation that the SOs and ACs are going to be involved in vetting applications and nominating standing panelists, and ICANN's legal and policy team is right now engaged in structuring a way to help SOs and ACs organize to address this function. In the Copenhagen meeting in March, I spoke to some of the SOs and ACs about this, and I'll talk about it in just a moment. But between the expression of interest and the process for viewing and sorting through applications, they are sort of on the immediate future, the immediate next steps for the community, and it's important to get it right and to get it done fairly quickly, I would think. I've had discussions with ICANN Legal. My point of contact is Sam Eisner. We're moving forward with the expression, and I do hope that in the meeting in Johannesburg there will be some additional discussions with the SO and AC leadership to sort of get this process nailed down. But to those on this group who participate in supporting organizations and or advisory committees, be aware that this important step of getting applications in, sorting through them, vetting them, and then for SOs and ACs together to nominate panelists, that is their role, strictly their role, it's in the immediate future. It's something that we need to get organized and get done. Any panelists that they nominate will have to be approved by the ICANN board, but that approval cannot be unreasonably withheld. So this, the reason I'm sort of spending a little time on this slide and this idea is, in order to get the new IRP up and running, this is the most important sort of two steps to be done right now. Issuing the expression of interest, that's ICANN's job, and then vetting and nominating panelists, which are the SO and AC's job. Next slide, please. This is just some information about the panelists. They'll serve a 5-year term. They have to be independent. There are a couple of bylaw provisions that deal with their independence and their qualifications. I spoke about the 3 members and the appeals. IRP is targeted to get to action within 6 months. I'll speak about that in the context of the community engagement process in a few minutes. And enforcement in court is envisioned. The bylaws provide that ICANN accepts that, you know, that a decision that has been left unaddressed by ICANN can be enforced in court. Next slide, please. The final main pillar, you know, the first one was the new standard, the second one was the standing panel. The third one, in my view, is the rules of procedure. These are extraordinarily important, and the IoT team has spent a lot of time on this recently. There is a link in these slides, if you have them, to the first draft of the updated rules. They were issued for public comment. We got some extensive comments, and we're working through those now. And the challenge that we have is we're a small group, and we have the same kind of fatigue from Workstream 1 that many groups do, but we're plowing through these, and we're making good progress and picking up speed. The rules that we've been grappling with recently are the time within which a claim must be filed. There were a lot of people dissatisfied with the original draft that said they had to be filed within 45 days of a claimant becoming aware of the harm, or not later than 12 months after ICANN's action. We're dealing with retroactivity of the new standard to pending IRP cases, and we're dealing with retroactivity of the rules themselves to pending IRP cases. We're dealing with joinder of interested parties. That's of interest to this group because when someone claims that the decision of an expert panel below violated the bylaws, that will tend to be the loser of the case below. Obviously, they're the ones that are going to complain about it. Well, the winner of the case below should have some way to join in that IRP. At least many of the people have made a public comment, made that comment, and we're addressing that. And finally, challenge to consensus policies. We're dealing with that and starting into some other issues as well. Next slide, please. Some miscellaneous bits. The bylaws, the IRP bylaws, contemplate a cooperative engagement process before a claim is filed that the claimant and ICANN will get together and try and resolve their differences. It's an informal attempt, but this can have an impact in the case in two respects. One is it can affect timing, and timing has been a discussion that we've had a lot of angst around, and a lot of dedicated time spent dealing with it. The other thing is it's CEP involvement. Parties it's not obligatory on them, but if they don't participate in a CEP and then lose their IRP, they can be held responsible for ICANN's legal fees. So it's sort of an informal cudgel over their head to participate in CEP. So that has some impacts, and we need to deal with it. There's also a separate part of the bylaw that talks about conciliation efforts. Once an IRP is actually started, conciliation is hopefully the claimant and ICANN getting together to narrow the issues under review. The IRP IoT status has to be addressed. That is our status, our team. We're a small team. We started under Workstream 1. We're now a bylaws team. Aubrey brought up a very good point last discussion. We need to clarify our status going forward, and I think that we will make recommendations in this respect and make it a more transparent, more solid basis kind of thing. And then finally, I show there's a bylaw that deals with access, saying ICANN will look for some way to help people who financially struggle to take part in IRP to be able to do it. You can see the language on the screen. Nonprofit claimants can't be assumed as all being financially struggling, so that might need some attention. But by and large, the important bits here, I think, are that these expert panels' decisions can be reviewed at IRP. IRP is now substantive, not just procedural, and I think there's some real protections for people that get engaged in the application for new GTLDs. I think I can wrap it up there and take questions, and hopefully this wasn't too long. Thank you.
Thanks, David. And I see we've had some good discussion in the chat, and since Jeff initiated that discussion and he has his hand raised, I will go to him, and he can ask his question so we can get David's input on that. Jeff, go ahead.
Thanks. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Hey, David, thanks for coming on. I think that the discussion that we're having, and I noticed at the end you said that this may substantively review some of the new GTLD stuff, and that was the intention. But I think, again, I'm taking my chair's hat off here, I don't think the changes go far enough. And the problem is that the substantive review is still whether or not the bylaws, an action or an inaction, caused a breach of the bylaws. I know I'm rephrasing liberally. But there is nothing that would act as an appeals mechanism of something that was a breach of the applicant guidebook, unless it was to a degree where such action or inaction was also a violation of the bylaws. It would be pretty hard to actually say that every violation of the guidebook is per se a violation of the bylaws. In fact, I would think very few violations of the guidebook would be construed as a violation of the bylaws. And so what people have been arguing is that this IRP is, while better, certainly, and it doesn't just look for the good faith of the board directors, but it also doesn't cover appeals for places where ICANN staff, board, or contractors just got the decision wrong for whatever reason. Substantively, they just, you know, made an incorrect decision. They used an inappropriate standard in the guidebook, or they, you know, any reasonable person would have done something differently. So I don't think this goes far enough in terms of being a substitute for an appeals mechanism. And I think that, you know, reconsideration was also asked about, and that still is a standard of whether the action or inaction violated the core mission, the core values or the mission or the bylaws, or whether there was information that was not considered at the time of the decision. I still don't think that goes far enough. And to add on top of that, there's a very broad disclaimer, as we all know, in the applicant terms and conditions, which says that and is, you know, disclaimed from any potential liability for anything it does. And so all of those combined means that, you know, if someone doesn't like the decision of the string similarity panel, assuming we have something like that going forward, there's really nothing that anyone could do absent an appeals mechanism to have that decision reviewed de novo on a substantive decision. So that's what I want people to consider when we think about whether we should have an appeals concept or not. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. It's David here. I agree with what you just said. This gives me an opportunity to remind everyone that I'm speaking here as the on behalf of the IoT, and they've seen these slides, and I'm doing my best, but I'm speaking personally in this respect. But I think you're right. It's not dissimilar from PTI service complaints. You know, not every contract breach is material. And so the panel is going to have to wrestle with some of this. And so when you get a decision on string similarity review, you know, whether a singular and a plural are similar, when you get something like that, it's conceivable that a claimant could bring a claim like that and argue that it's a breach of the bylaws, and I would presume that ICANN would say it wasn't, and the panel may have to wrestle with this. But there are some unclear areas like you just touched on. And do you want to go ahead?
Yes, thank you, David. It's Ann Aikman Scalise. It's a question for you and Aubrey and Jeff about the scope of the work that's being done in Workstream 2, because when Jeff is raising the issue of a breach of the guidebook provisions, it strikes me as something that talks about what's the scope of an IRP. I know that he's focused on having an appeal process, but I think initially what we would have to be looking at to consider the idea that Jeff has raised is what's a valid claim to be filed in an IRP. Is it within scope? And so especially addressing you and Avery in terms of implementation, it strikes me that Workstream 2 is not going to be able to change the scope of Workstream 1 work, and that's before getting to any other issues I might have on the substance of this, and I did put something into the chat, but is this really within scope for us to change the scope of an IRP in Workstream 2?
Hi, Ann. It's David again. I would argue, I mean, my personal take on this is that the bylaws are written, and so anything that would change the scope of an IRP that's suggested by another group would have to be suggested in the context of an amendment to the bylaws. But when we talk about scope, let me just mention to those who are interested in looking at the provisions, if you go to 4.3b, you'll get to scope. And roughly speaking, the IRP is going to be able to hear claims that what are called, quote, covered actions constituted an action or an inaction by ICANN's staff, board, or the folks I mentioned, that violate articles or that violate bylaws. And when I used covered actions in quotes, that gets to the notion, the further notion that what this covers is it deals with someone being, quote, materially affected by the action. So it's not just anyone. Someone has to have standing by being materially affected by whatever that action was, and that material effect has to be harm that was directly caused by the action. So there are restrictions on what an IRP can hear, and I hear your point. But if someone's interested in the scope, go to 4.3B, and it will give you a pretty good sense of what an IRP can deal with. Jeff, over to you.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
Just quickly, I want to remind everyone that we do have a second speaker teed up. So we'll go to Jeff, and then we will go to our next speaker, and then we can come back to this very interesting topic after she's done. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. Sorry about that. For the record, because I think Anne was kind of wasn't interpreting, or I wasn't clear. I'm not arguing that we should be pushing for a change to the scope of the IRP at all. What I'm saying is because I believe, again, taking my chair hat off, that the appeals process that the IRP does not cover much of what an appeals process would. I am arguing that perhaps we consider developing a new TLD-only appeals process that would go in the guidebook, that would not go in the bylaws or anything like that, a completely separate process. The only reason I brought up the IRP is to make the case that the IRP wouldn't cover 90% of the potential appeals that applicants would want. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. And we will certainly take a further, deeper look at this proposal for a separate appeals mechanism. But for right now, let's move on. We have with us, and thank you again, David, for joining us today. Appreciate it very much. It's very insightful. We have with us also today Karen Mellon-Charville from Mark Monitor. Karen was involved in the only PIC DRP to be filed to date, which was a consortium of private interest brand holders against the DOT feedback registry for violation of their public interest commitments in the registry agreement. And having been through that process, Karen has agreed to come and share with us some observations about how that process went. Just a reminder, the substance of PICs, of public interest commitments, is being dealt with within WorkTrack 2 itself. So we're not looking at the substance and what makes a good PIC or not, and how that aspect is affects subsequent procedures. We're looking at the accountability procedure itself. So with that, I will turn it over to Karen. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Karen. I appreciate it. This is Karen Mellon-Charville, as Karen has introduced me already. I'm the policy counselor at Mark Monitor. I was one of the parties to the PIC DRP that was filed on behalf of a number of brand owners, as Karen correctly identified. It actually, just one point of clarification, it was not the first PIC DRP to be filed, but it was the first PIC DRP to make it to sort of pass the initial review of ICANN to a standing panel and to an actual decision. So it was, I think other people had filed PIC DRPs, but had not been successful at reaching the panel stage, although there are some transparency concerns, which we'll discuss. It's a little bit difficult to discuss scope and procedure absent discussing the substance of PICs, but I will do my best. So, Karen, if you can help, if I'm saying anything that is more appropriately dealt with in Work Track 2, which, of course, I'm also involved in, then, you know, please just jump in and tell me that that's not within scope here. But essentially, by way of background, the purpose of the PICs were to ensure that the GTLDs are operated in the public interest. As many of us remember, way back in the day, they were implemented as a result of the GAC's concerns about the sort of promises and commitments that were made in new GTLD applications. As some PICs are mandatory and some are voluntary, I think that will all sort of be dealt with in Work Track 2. But the PIC DRP process and procedure was a way for parties to bring a complaint against registry operators, feasibly to, you know, help enforce the prohibition of contracted parties from engaging in things like fraud and deceptive practices and other malicious and abusive conduct. As many in the community have noted, the PIC DRP process is sort of arduous and complicated. The GAC has made comments to that effect. It is sort of rife with uncertainty and lack of transparency. And we sort of soldiered through anyway as a coalition. And I will note that our counsel on this matter for the coalition was Mayor Brown. Many of you know Brian Winterfeldt and his colleague Sarah Deutsch. They were the lead counsel on this on behalf of the coalition. And they have prepared comments, by the way, to the CCT review team that are public comments that go into more detail about the things that we're going to talk about today. But that's sort of a good sort of background background information for what we're talking about today. I think that at the end of the day, the problem with the PIC DRP was truly fell on ICANN's shoulders. So there was a lot of transparency violations. The first and sort of, to me, the most troubling was that the PIC DRP takes you through a number of complaint processes and essentially filings, which sort of mirrors the court case in that way. You know, we file, they file a response, et cetera, et cetera. And we noted that ICANN regularly shared all of the coalition's complaints and filings and responses and reports. There was a settlement conference at one point, and you know, we submitted our sort of conclusion and findings, and that was shared. All of that was shared with Top Level Spectrum, which is the was the respondent in this case. This was the dot feedback registry. And so ICANN shared all of the coalition's filings with TLS, but refused to share any of TLS's responses or filings with us. So obviously that was sort of the number one procedural problem from my perspective, that that was not okay. And when we approached that with ICANN, we did not get a satisfactory answer. We actually didn't get an answer at all, truly, about why that was, except for something vague about protecting the contracted parties, which obviously in a dispute resolution process, if ICANN is going to be sort of biased towards protecting contracted party interests, then they are not appropriately the administrators for this type of complaint. So that's something that should be flagged as a procedural difficulty with the PIC DRP. The second is that we, as the coalition, got no notice regarding the convening and composition of the PIC DRP standing panel. We were pretty much in the dark from the time we filed the PIC DRP to when we got the decision, and unless we followed up with ICANN and we were sort of biting flies on the back of ICANN compliance, we received no actual information. The real problem with this, and I think I brought this up last time this group met, was no notice about the composition of the standing panel. So we weren't able to actually look at who was on the panel, identify potential conflicts of interest, and that obviously is a huge problem to the integrity of the PIC DRP process. After the PIC DRP gave their findings, which was sort of a limited finding of a violation of the PICs based on sort of the narrow scope in which they were instructed to address the PICs, which I will also speak to briefly, they they TLS apparently submitted to ICANN compliance a remediation plan that was meant to address the violations that the standing panel had identified. And we received no details as complainants about TLS's remediation plan regarding the numerous PIC violations that were identified. And so we had no way of understanding what has happened, whether that was adequate. So we had absolutely no say in understanding whether the remedy was appropriate for the coalition members and whether or not it was going to address our numerous complaints. So essentially, there were a lot of due process violations. Oh, and I will mention one other thing. During the standing panel's deliberations on the PIC DRP, ICANN instructed the panel on the scope of the PIC DRPs, which we believe was probably a violation of ICANN's neutral role in this decision. Of course, that sort of starts crossing the line into the actual scope and substance of the PIC DRP, but essentially the ICANN told the panel that the registries were only had to prohibit fraud from others, from they only had to have in the language that registrants must prohibit fraud, but have no obligation to avoid fraudulent and deceptive practices itself. Now, whether or not it was appropriate for ICANN to actually instruct the panel on that scope rather than the panel making a fresh determination themselves as to the scope of the PIC DRP, I consider that a process violation, considering ICANN's intended role in the PIC DRPs, but I think that that's something that should be flagged for further discussion. I will note that two out of the three panelists made a comment as to the ridiculousness of the PIC DRP process. David Cairns, I don't know this person, but Cairns maybe, C-A-I-R-N-S is his last name, stated that the PIC DRP purports to be a dispute resolution mechanism but only addresses a limited range of public interest concerns, and he sort of flagged the PIC DRP as a little bit inadequate for its intended purpose. Scott Austin, also a panelist and I think an esteemed member of the community, I have heard his name before, he suggested a full conversation about the PIC DRP, which is perhaps what we're trying to start here, about goals and best practices to see if this sort of well-intended public interest commitments and this dispute resolution process can actually be something that is useful to the community. I think essentially what we learned from the PIC DRP is that the PICs are inadequate, which is a work track 2 issue, and that the process was a fat mess, basically. Excuse my bluntness. So that's our issue here, work track 3. I think also, as an aside, but something that deals very much with process and procedure and ICANN's roles in administering the PIC, the registry operator, TLS, after the PIC DRP was filed and decided, and apparently they engaged in some remediation, which remains to be seen what that is, and whether or not it was adequate, also then turned around and we were the only registrar that was a part of the coalition, but they turned around and engaged in some retaliatory behavior by claiming that we had a confidentiality breach by association. We did not give our registrar agreement, but there was an unsigned registrar agreement given by a different party into the complaint and to demonstrate the terms therein. And, TLS made a claim that we had sort of violated confidentiality by proxy and proceeded to terminate or to request termination, rather, of our RRA with them, our accreditation with them, unless we did a number of things, which, of course, then we declined to do, and we proceeded with termination of the RRA. So obviously we anticipated that that might be a problem, but it is a failure of the process and procedures of the PICDRP that the complainants are not actually protected from those kinds of retaliatory behavior from registries. Obviously, we should feel free to use the dispute resolution and complaint mechanisms within ICANN without worrying about retaliation and problems thereof. So that I also sort of identified as a procedural ICANN failure. So I know we're sort of at the end of the call, so I think I'll stop there, but hopefully that's a good start to understanding a little bit about the process and procedure and ICANN's roles in the PICs and how that was mostly problematic.
Thank you so much, Kieran. Does anyone have, we are close to the end of the call, but I did want to give the chance for anyone who has any questions to raise them at this point, and then perhaps Kieran could address them offline if we don't have time to today. Does anyone have any questions? I see there is, Susan Payne, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks. Just a quick one. Thanks, Kieran. The stages during which information that you shared with ICANN and which wasn't a sort of reciprocal arrangement, and some of the procedural matters where you said you really kept informed. Did that all happen before the complaint went to the panel? Or was there also an issue about sort of documents that you submitted to the panel getting shared, but documents that they submitted to the panel didn't as well? And I wasn't quite sure where I can sort of stop having a role in this, if you know what I mean.
Right. It's a little bit difficult for me to recall the exact timeline. I'm going to have to actually get back to you with certainty, but I will say that I am 90% sure that the vast majority of our filings and ICANN sharing them or not sharing them happened before the panel. I believe that once the panel was convened, it was sort of like sealed off at that point. And aside from the panel coming back to ICANN and asking them about the scope of the PICs, which then they instructed them, correctly or not, then we didn't hear anything about the panel, and we were not invited to submit anything further to the panel, and we were asking about who was on the panel to try to deal with conflicts of interest. So I do not believe we submitted anything after we were told the panel was convened. Now, don't forget, we weren't told that the panel was convened until way after it was. So I'm not entirely sure. So I will note that question and respond on the list, but I'm pretty sure that the vast majority of the sharing of documents and not sharing of documents happened before the panel.
Thanks, Kieran and Susan. We're going to let Alan ask his question, and then we will move to wrap up our meeting. Alan, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Alan Greenberg speaking. Just a general comment and question, not necessarily at Kieran, and clearly we're not going to have a lot of time for discussion of it. The DRP is a method of a harmed party claiming a problem, but ICANN itself is in a position through compliance to enforce complaints or to take action on any other complaints on violations of the PICs. And I'm just wondering, to what extent are we aware of, do we know any details of, has that happened? What kind of actions has ICANN taken? It would be nice to know what the other half of the PIC DRP enforcement mechanism is and to what extent that has been effective or not effective. Thank you.
So, Alan, this is Kieran. If I understand your question, are you asking, like, to what extent has ICANN actually enforced the findings of the standing panel? Because I think I meant to make it clear that we have been asking ICANN that question, if that is your question,
No.
Which was part of the question about the remediation. So I'm sorry, can you clarify then if that's not correct?
Yeah. The PIC DRP is a method to allow you to complain that the PICs were violated and you were harmed and you want some action. But a simple complaint to compliance, in theory, should result in some level of action by ICANN against the registry or making sure that the PICs are being enforced and are being followed properly. But I don't have any real feeling, nor have I tried to actively look for it, of to what extent have there been complaints, has ICANN taken action. It's sort of a, from my perspective, rather a black box, and it would be useful
that's
to know.
That's a great question. That's a great question, Alan, and thank you for clarifying. I will note that since the standing panel did not, they declined on the issue of scope to address the various complaints that we made about the deceptive and fraudulent practices, and I won't go into detail about our complaint against TLS. That's also public record in our CCT comments, so people can look at that if they want the background. But we have now sort of escalated those concerns since the standing panel hasn't actually chosen to address them to ICANN, so it will be interesting to see, and hopefully that will address some of your query. It'll be interesting to see sort of whether or not how ICANN runs with a simple complaint now as opposed to a PICDRP, because now it's sort of escalated or perhaps de-escalated into a complaint.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Alan. We are over time, so we will continue both aspects of our discussion today, the IRP, the need for a separate, appeal process for TLDs, and the PICs, and we'll work with staff to see if we can come up with some data on Alan's question. Now let's move on and just very quickly I wanted to tee up for you what we are going to be discussing in Johannesburg at ICANN 59. During our session of the face-to-face, if staff could go on to the next slide, we are going to be looking at GAC advice and how GAC early warning impact freedom of expression and the application process. I feel like this will be a lively discussion while we're together in Johannesburg. So please come prepared with any thoughts and input you may have on that. And if time allows, in our allotted segment during the entire face-to-face, we deal with the GAC sufficiently, because miracles could happen, we will pick up with where we left off today with the appeals mechanism possibility. Hope to see you there in Johannesburg. On the next slide for everyone, which will be made available, are the times for our different sessions in Johannesburg. We have our face-to-face on Tuesday morning. We have the first GeoName session on Monday afternoon, and then we have the second Geo session on Thursday afternoon. So then after that, we will come back and pick up with our CC2 input and start to finalize our thoughts here in WorkTrack 3 on objections process. So with that, I will close today's meeting, and we will wish everyone safe travels to Johannesburg if you're going. If not, we will be back together later in July. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Karen.
Bye.
And today's meeting is adjourned. Please disconnect all lines. And to everyone, thank you and have a great day.